Hi, my name is Joel Bryce. Obviously, in light of coronavirus, we are still online, so I have the incredible privilege of speaking to you from my home office, which is pretty awkward for me, so somehow I'm going to try to engage with you wherever you are in your home. Actually, I know you're in your home because you are in lockdown mode. I'm married to Sarah Bryce. You guys may remember, if you were with us about a month ago, Sarah spoke at church. We have two little girls, Victoria and Aubrielle. We are continuing our series today on Hello, It's Jesus. So we're introducing the life of Jesus through the book of Mark. Today we're talking about Jesus and the skeptic. So here's the thing about me. I'm a bit of a skeptic. I find it very difficult to accept things at face value. I often challenge ideas that are presented. I think that's probably made me an annoying person to work with at times. But that kind of spills over into all areas of my life, including my faith. I grew up in a Christian family. My dad is a pastor. It was a very healthy family. But I still have found myself asking a lot of tough questions of God and my faith. And I'm going to be vulnerable and just share a few of those, but there's a lot of them, if I'm honest. How do I reconcile the scientific reality of evolutionary biology and Genesis and the story of creation? How do I make sense of so much that I read in the scriptures with the apparent lack of those items in my lived experience, be it miracles or the like, and the lived experience of others around me? And perhaps in my darker days, I ask a lot of questions around, where is God? Where is God in the world? When I think a lot of people actually are probably asking that question right now. Thousands and thousands of deaths from COVID-19. We're all kind of isolated in our homes. In South Africa here, we're in lockdown. I do a lot of work all across the continent of Africa, and I've found in some of my most painful moments of looking at the history of this continent, as recent as last year in Mozambique, one of our businesses there that we work with was affected massively by cyclones Idai and Kenneth. But you could look at example after example, from the Rwandan genocide to what Belgium did in the Congo in the early 19th century, to the Atlantic slave trade with 18 to 25 million Africans taken from their homes and families. This continent kind of bubbles with this question and births with this question, where is God? And the reality is, these are tough questions. And Jesus was often asked difficult questions, and that's what we're going to look at today. I'd encourage you, in fact, while you're kind of sitting at home listening to me, to take a moment and ask yourself, or even just pause maybe it's a live stream, I don't know if you can pause it, but if you can, pause it and just write down a question, or if you're with somebody, explain it to them. What's a question that you have of God? Today's focus is on a story in which Jesus was questioned by some skeptics. There's three areas I'm going to talk about. The first is, why do we question? The second is, how does Jesus respond to our questions? And then the third is, when do our questions become less important? Before I jump into that, though, I'm going to set up a little bit of context. And if I may, I'm going to share a skeptic's question. How do we trust the account in the Bible that we're about to read? So this is a bit of a kind of an interlude, if you will. Remember what I told you about me. I can be fairly skeptical. What if the Bible was written by people years ago to control the kind of human experience in light of the pain and suffering in the world, that to give people hope outside of their condition? The reality is, I don't believe that's true, but I recall when I was in university, I took a class on world religions. I remember a scholarly article that was presented in which It stated that the Gospels were simply oral traditions embellished with legendary and kind of fairy tale elements, but we couldn't actually take them as fact because they were written hundreds of years after the life of Jesus. I'm not going to fully unpack why I do not believe that to be true, and why I rather believe that the Gospels, while are oral histories, they were captured by eyewitnesses themselves. If you're interested in that question, I'd recommend a book by Dr. Richard Bachman called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. I'd like to briefly look from that book at who Mark is. So we've been talking about Mark for the last kind of 2 months. Most scholars agree that Mark was a secretary and a translator of Peter. Peter was one of the 12 disciples. He spent a lot of time with Jesus. Interestingly, throughout Mark, there's very little that happens that you see where Peter is not present, which gives kind of an indication that Mark was truly kind of the secretary and translator of Peter. I found it kind of fascinating because what I wasn't sure about, and I've studied in preparation for this, but also kind of previously, how do we know that this account of Peter's, as scribed by Mark, is accurate? The way we know this to be true is a guy by the name of Papias of Hierapolis. He was a bishop of Hierapolis. He lived from 60 to 130 AD. Okay? He was friends with John. John was another of the 12 disciples who actually outlived all the other disciples. And so Papias of Hierapolis knew John, and the work of Papias is dated, most scholars agree with this, biblical and non-biblical scholars agree, that the work of Papias was dated around 95 AD. And based on his friendship with John, who was an eyewitness of Jesus's, he wrote the following. In manuscripts that are agreed by biblical and non-biblical scholars alike, the elder John used to say, Mark, in his capacity as Peter's interpreter, wrote down accurately as many things as he recalled from memory, though not in an ordered form of the things said and done by the Lord. There's actually an incredible work because it's, 1950 years old of this man, but he spent enough time with John, and John recounted to him who Mark was, this guy who spent a lot of time with Peter. I might have lost you at this point. And forgive me if I have, but just bear with me. To some of you who maybe are skeptics like me, that might be an important reality for accepting what we're about to read. I want to get into the text, but before we do, let's briefly remember where we are. So we're in Mark 12. There are 16 chapters in Mark, so we're about 75% of the way through. And we know the end. We know that Jesus is killed. That's not quite the full end of the story, as we'll see next week, obviously, but he's killed. And at this point in the story, we've had a number of miracles happen, right? We remember the story of Jesus feeding 5,000, of my wife when she spoke on raising Jesus raising the little girl from the dead. Marcia spoke on the paralyzed man being lowered into the house. So all of these events have happened, and things are starting to get a little heated. He's starting to ruffle the feathers of the religious elite. And that's the context that we're stepping into now. So let's jump into Mark 12. We'll start in verse 13. Then they sent to him some of the Pharisees and the Herodians? I'm not sure. To catch him in his words. When they had come, they said to him, Teacher, we know that you are true and care about no one, for you do not regard the person of men, but teach the way of God in truth. You can almost hear their sarcasm. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Shall we pay or shall we not pay? But he, knowing their hypocrisy, said to them, Why do you test me? He answers their question with a question. Bring me a denarius, that I may see it. So they brought it. And he said to them, Whose inscription is this? They said, It is Caesar's. And Jesus said, Then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God, that are God's. And they marveled at him. And then some Sadducees. Let me pause for a moment. So there's these two groups, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. they're kind of different groups, and they differ in their doctrinal beliefs around sacred texts. So the Pharisees believed that in kind of oral history, whereas the Sadducees only believed in the written word. Secondly, the Sadducees did not believe in the spiritual realm, whereas the Pharisees believed in angels and demons. And that relates to this question, is the Sadducees also did not believe in the afterlife, whereas the Pharisees did. So here comes the Sadducees with their specific question in light of their beliefs. Then came some Sadducees who say there is no resurrection. And they came to him and they asked him, saying, "Teacher, Moses wrote to us that if a man's brother dies and leaves his wife behind and leaves no children, his brother should take up his wife and raise up offspring for his brothers. Now there were seven brothers. The first took a wife, and dying he left no offspring. And the second took her, and he died, nor did he leave any offspring. And the third likewise. So the seven had her and left no offspring." Poor lady. Seven brothers, all dead. "Last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrection, when they rise, whose wife will she be? For all seven had her as wife." Jesus answered and said to them, "Are you not mistaken?" Once again, he answers their question with a question. "Because you do not know the scriptures, nor the power of God. For when they rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage. But they are like the angels in heaven. But concerning the dead that they rise, have you not read in the book of Moses, in the burning bush passage, how God spoke to him, saying, 'I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living. You are therefore greatly mistaken.'" So the first area I want to talk about today is, why do we question? Why are we skeptical? In my own experience, I can think of four reasons in my life when I've been skeptical and when I question. These aren't empirically based, they're just my observations of my own life. The first is when I've been hurt, I can become disillusioned. I think we can all probably relate to this, because human pain is just part of our experience. When we first moved to South Africa about 5.5 years ago now, South Africa's home for us. Our daughter was born here. She was born about 6 weeks after we moved. Note to the men out there who maybe have a pregnant wife, probably best not to make a decision to move halfway around the world, start a new job, you know, find an apartment, set up a bank, buy a car, just before your wife has a baby. And our baby came with complications. Victoria spent a little bit of time in the NICU. But when she was born, there were moments where I was alone, where I was separated from Sarah. Sarah was recovering from an emergency cesarean section. And I was making decisions on behalf of my daughter that I felt completely ill-equipped to be making. Things like, should I freeze her brain or not? It's not really worth getting into all the details. The point is, Victoria was in a critical state, and I was being told to prepare my wife for the worst. Now, Victoria is named Victoria because of victory. We couldn't get pregnant for a number of years. This was our victory baby, and now I'm being told I have to prepare my wife for the worst. And I found a sneaking question deep in the caves of my heart, kind of working its way out, that was asking questions about God's character. I don't know if that was entirely fair of me at the time, but that was the reality. And I think anybody who's experienced incredible pain or hurt will relate with that. I think that's one of the reasons why we often question and why we're skeptical, is our hurt. I think the second is we're afraid. It's our fear. If this story is true, that God became man via a virgin birth, that he lived a life, that he was crucified and killed, and that he rose again from the dead. If this story is true, what does it require of us? The reality is that sparks in us a bit of fear. What might it mean of me? And so therefore, it's much easier to be skeptical, to ask questions, to disprove the faith. Because if it is true, what might it mean for my life? And then the third reason, I think, is the motivation of these Pharisees and these Sadducees. I think it's our pride. I think we haven't encountered God You know, Mark says that the Pharisees came to, quote, catch him in his words. I think there's times when it's simply our pride that is motivating our questions, that we're out to prove God wrong or prove Christians wrong. But I think there's a fourth reason as well. And I think that reason is a genuine desire to seek truth and to find truth. And that is what I think the motivation is of this scribe who now steps into the story. So let's pick up the reading now in verse 28. Then one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, perceiving that he answered them well, asked him, "Which is the first commandment of all?" Jesus answered him, "The first of all commandments is, 'Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength.' This is the first commandment. And the second, like it, is this, 'You shall love your neighbor as yourself.' There is no other commandment greater than these." So the scribe said to him, "Well said, teacher, you have spoken the truth, for there is only one God, and there is no other but he. And to love him with all the heart, and with all the understanding, and with all the soul, and with all the strength, and to love one's neighbor as oneself, is more than all the whole burnt offerings and sacrifices." You know, I think, you know why I think this is one of, that was a real genuine question. It was from this place of genuinely seeking truth. The first is, this is a scribe. A scribe was a kind of a mix between a theologian and a teacher. They spent considerable time studying laws. At this time, there were 613 references to Levitical law that were hotly contested at the time. And scribes would often debate which is the most important. And you can almost, you know, sense the scribe, his genuine desire to know, oh, wow, he just answered these Pharisees and these Sadducees incredibly well. Because it says that, perceiving that he answered them well. He then comes in and says, "Now I have my question," which is the most important question that he'd been debating with his colleagues for years. Which commandment is the greatest? That's the first reason why I think it's a genuine question. And the second is Mark captures these nonverbals. I really like it about the idea of Mark writing down the kind of eyewitness account of Peter, as I said earlier. You know, earlier Mark captured this nonverbal where he said they tried to catch him in his words. Or later when they said, and they marveled at him. Nothing is being said. It's just Peter explaining to Mark what he saw and then writing it down. In this one, he says, perceiving that he answered them well. In that nonverbal, you can almost see Peter catching this one guy who's watching the Sadducees and the Pharisees whispering after Jesus' question for them. And now he turns to Jesus with his question. I think there's a genuine desire to seek truth here. And I think there's times in our own lives when we ask questions of God or of Jesus or of our faith that come from a genuine place. And now I'd like to look at how does Jesus respond to our questions. Jesus responds with, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God." The Lord our God is one. This is something that is said when what follows is really important. It's called the Shema. The Shema was recited in the morning and evening by most faithful Jews. The morning as soon as they woke up, and in the evening just before they went to bed. Isn't that beautiful? We spend most of our time right before bed or in the morning looking at our phones. I know I'm guilty of that. But Jesus first is about to say, before he says his answer to the guy, he says, "Listen up. What I'm about to say is important." Here's what that would have sounded like in Hebrew. Shema lavach nabash avava ma'oth. That's actually not what it sounded like in Hebrew. I just simply made that up. Which I find really funny. But I also find it funny because I'm doing that to myself in my home office. I have no idea what it sounded like in Hebrew, but I do know this. Jesus was announcing that what he's about to say is really important. And the first thing that is so simple, but when we think about how Jesus responds to our questions, the first thing is he answers them. Here's the thing. When our motivation is a genuine desire to seek truth, Jesus answers us. He can stand up to our scrutiny. Either this whole thing is real or it's not. And if it's real, then it can handle our questions. It can handle our scrutiny. Jesus is not afraid of your questions. There's nothing wrong with your questions when the motivation is genuinely trying to seek truth. Secondly, and this is so interesting to me, he doesn't answer him in a parable or a question. Most of the time, Jesus did. I read this week when I was preparing for this message that there were 183 times that Jesus was asked a question between the four Gospels, and only three times did he answer those questions directly. Most of the time, he gave a beautiful parable that probably frustrated his listeners. When he was asked, "Who is my neighbor?" in the Gospel of Luke, he went into the most, probably one of the most famous quoted parables of Jesus' teaching, the parable of the Good Samaritan. You know, in the scriptures that we just read by the Pharisees and the Sadducees, he answered with questions. It was not uncommon for Jesus, when he was asked a tough question, to look back and ask a question back of his kind of skeptic. I think that the fact that Jesus answers the question and he chooses to answer it directly shows the importance of this question and the importance of the answer that's coming. But thirdly, I think what's interesting about how Jesus responds to this question is he completely reorients the common worldview of this man and of those who studied the law at the time. Because it's important what he did not say. So what he did not talk about in his answer was temple sacrifices. If you go back and you read in Leviticus, which is kind of the book of laws that I referenced earlier, perhaps if you're struggling to fall asleep at night, forgive me if I'm offending anybody, that might be a book to read. It's a book of kind of laws, and many times they're quite dry. But they often, and I was reading some of them this week just to kind of prepare, and you see how many times one is to atone his or her uncleanness by going to the temple priest and bringing some form of a sacrifice. That might have been what the scribe would expect Jesus to answer. But Jesus does not answer that way. He answers beautifully by speaking about love, loving God, and loving your neighbor. Here's the thing. When we ask our questions of Jesus, and they come from a place of our genuine desire for truth, I believe that he answers us, and that he does it directly, and that he does it in a way that completely reorients the way we see the world, and the way we see ourselves, and the way we see our history, like he did with the scribe. Okay, lastly, what I want to talk about is, when do our questions become less important? So let's pick up again and read in verse 34. "Now when Jesus saw that he answered wisely, he said to him, 'You are not far from the kingdom of God.' But after that, no one dared question him." So when do our questions become less important, that we no longer dare to question him? Here's the best part. In the midst of the skepticism and in the midst of these questions, Jesus focuses on love, loving God and loving our neighbor. I think we could have spent probably 30 minutes just talking about that simple answer of Jesus, about loving God with all our hearts, minds, soul, and strength, and to love our neighbor as ourselves. I'm not going to spend 30 minutes doing that. You're welcome. But I do want to say a couple of things about what Jesus said here. Love is active. It doesn't stop with just loving God in kind of our quiet place. It actually is going out and loving our neighbor. And I think, as I was just looking a little bit into the history of what the word neighbor would have meant in that time, it's very different than what we understand neighbor to mean. I think it primarily revolves around the notion of proximity to us. That we think of neighbor, we think of somebody who lives probably next to us. We use that word literally, "He or she is my neighbor," which one would assume to mean one or two houses down from you. which therefore means that they probably are in a similar socioeconomic or income bracket as you. They're very much like you. But that is not how Jesus' listeners would have understood love your neighbor as yourself. For that one, we're going to turn to everyone's favorite book that I just referenced, Leviticus, chapter 19, verse 9. In the ESV translation, this part of Leviticus is actually entitled, Love Your Neighbor. I listened to a sermon and somebody mentioned that. I didn't proof or fact check it, but it's entitled, Love Your Neighbor. Chapter 19, verse 9. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. You shall not glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather every grape of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. I am the Lord your God. This was the Jewish practice of gleaning, leaving a portion of your field or your vineyard for the poor. See, when Jesus said, love your neighbor, what he was actually saying was to love your neighbor is to create margin in your life to love the poor. And, you know, I think he knew his listeners would have received that as such. Jesus answers with an invitation to love. But I think he knew something. I think he knew that one cannot love God and love our neighbor if they have not first received love. Mike Bickle says, it takes God to love God. And you know how I know that to be true? Because I have children. Children only learn to speak by responding to speech. The other night, it was Friday night, Sarah and I were with our girls at the dinner table, and Victoria went to the bathroom. Victoria's our five-year-old, she's our eldest. She came back to the bathroom, and as she kind of walked around the table, she was kind of skipping, being, you know, goofy or something, and Abrielle, our two-year-old, said, Sissy's a cheeky bubba, which we obviously laughed, but we know that Abrielle didn't on her own think of Sissy being a cheeky bubba. It's because she's heard her mother say that Victoria is a cheeky bubba. Children learn to speak by responding to speech. We learn the love of God by responding to his love. We learn his love that way. We can't love God if we haven't first received love. I want to read from one of my favorite books in the Bible, 1 John. This comes from one of the other 12 followers of Jesus. And it says this. This is 1 John 4, verse 7. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. And everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love. And then verse 16. And we have known and believed the love that God has for us. God is love. He who abides in love abides in God and God in him. Here's the thing. When we encounter love, it's not that we no longer have questions. It's just that the answers become less important to us. All of those questions that I was asking at the beginning, I do have answers for them because I've spent time kind of studying them because they're important to me. But the truth is the answers themselves are no longer nearly as important to me because I've experienced and I've received love from God. St. Augustine in Confessions calls it the gong in his soul. When something moves from his head to his heart, this kind of internal knowing. Tim Keller calls it an intuitive assurance, no longer an intellectual assurance. This became really real for me when I was kind of between the age of 18 and 20. I was battling a real severe depression. Quite a bit of anxiety. I debated sharing the story, and it still can make me emotional sharing the story, even when I'm just sharing it with my Canon camera here. But I thought when Siv shared a few weeks ago, if you were with us, when he shared about the story in South Korea that he said he only shared a couple of times in public, I thought I'd share the story. I was completely riddled with anxiety. There wasn't really a reason for it. I had a very kind of typical middle income Canadian kind of childhood, no real trauma in my life, so to speak. But when I was 18, I started to encounter kind of a deep inner unrest, anxiety and depression. I would wake up in the morning with hives all over my body. I couldn't eat early in the morning. I would kind of be dry heaving or throw up at the start of my day. I dreaded each day. There were nights that I was driving. I can get just a bit emotional thinking about it again, but there were nights that I would be driving my truck and I knew a spot that if I just veered off the road at that spot, it would take me instantly. And the reality is, I made a simple choice. I would get up before the sun was up, before anybody was awake, and I would sit before God. At the time, I was just sitting by myself or kneeling on my bedroom floor. And I would simply say, God, if you are real, I need you to show me yourself. I've grown up in this Christian faith, but I actually need an experience with you. Or I'm going to kind of not only walk away from this whole thing, but I'm at the time I was really quite suicidal. The thing is, in those moments, God was so gentle and kind. It was as if a warm blanket was wrapped around my shoulders, or that the feeling of getting into a hot bath on a winter night. It was this sense that there was somebody else in the room with me. And it was a sense that even now, as I share the story, I can feel the weight of that moment because it changed everything for me. It didn't change who I was, but it reoriented my worldview around how I saw myself, because I began to receive infinite love. If God is love, then what does it look like to receive from that love? It ultimately means then we can love God back. We can love our neighbor as ourselves. You know, I don't tell that story kind of, I think some people can hear that story and think, my goodness, I've never had an experience like that. Like, why haven't I? I can only say I pray that you do. I think God meets us when we're probably most desperate at times too. And I was in a really, really dark, desperate place and I needed it. But you know what keeps me on this Christian journey? Christians can be super weird people. I mean, we all kind of are, but Christians in particular can be super weird and make me often uncomfortable, if I'm honest. But you know what keeps me on this journey? It's that I've encountered love. It's not that my questions are any less important to God or to me. It's just that I know who I am as a son. If you're sitting here right now, listening to this, and there's maybe a quiet, an unquiet, or a dissatisfaction in your soul, it might be an indication of a need for God and a need for Him to reveal His love to you in only a way that you know how. It's not something that anybody can prescribe. But if you're feeling that, would you even if you're not, I'd like to just simply pray a prayer for you. So would you join me as we conclude? And wherever you are, just close your eyes and pray with me. God, I pray that that each person listening to this message right now would not be afraid of the questions that are deeply buried in their hearts. God, but you would just give them the freedom to ask those questions of you. If the questions are motivated by fear or by our hurt and our disillusionment or our pride, then you probably won't answer them. You might, because you're good and you're faithful. But if the questions are motivated from a genuine desire for truth, I pray, God, that you'd step into the stories of those who are listening right now. God, I pray that you would reveal your love, your infinite and incredible compassion for us just as we are, and that that love would change everything, that would reorient entirely who we are, and that we'd just begin to be able to live in a place of healthy love for you and love for others, but only if we've received your love. So would you be so gracious right now, today, to reveal your love abundantly? In your name we pray. Amen. We finish at Every Nation Bryanston every week with a blessing. I think it's a great idea. Shout out to Siv or whoever's idea it was. So will you just receive this blessing as you head into your week? The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Thanks, guys. Have a great week.